We're reading from the Red Books, page 19, and chapter 8, verses 5 to 13. When he entered Capernaum, a centurion came forward to him, appealing to him, "Lord, my servant is lying paralyzed at home, suffering terribly." And he said to him, "I will come and heal him." But the centurion replied, "Lord, I am not worthy to have you come under my roof. But only say the word, and my servant will be healed. For I too am a man under authority, with soldiers under me. And I say to one, 'Go,' and he goes. And to another, 'Come,' and he comes. And to my servant, 'Do this,' and he does it." When Jesus heard this, he marveled and said to those who followed him, "Truly, I tell you, with no one in Israel have I found such faith. I tell you, many will come from east and west and recline at table with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven, while the sons of the kingdom will be thrown into the outer darkness. In that place there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth." And to the centurion Jesus said, "Go, let it be done for you as you have believed." And the servant was healed at that very moment.
Well, Abby, thank you very much indeed for reading for us. May I add my welcome to Mark's. It's good to have you with us this afternoon. Late last year, the Norwich Union ran an advertisement for one of its pension schemes. You may have seen it, a series of pictures of a man in his 30s and then another in his 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, wrinkles increasing, hairline receding, girth expanding, with the caption underneath, "Invest in the future, yours." Now, all of us are inundated with people asking us to make a wise investment in the future, particularly here in the city. And what I want us to do this lunchtime is to think about an investment decision. Only instead of a picture of yourself in 10, 20, 30, 40 years' time, I'm going to ask us to hold in our heads a picture of ourselves in, say, 120. 240, 480 years' time. Now, the reading we just had read to us there on page 19 speaks of Jesus reclining at table with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. God's heavenly kingdom is often described in the Bible in the language of a feast, and Jesus is picking up that language right here. I've had tucked into your little Gospels there a copy of a prophecy from Isaiah 700 years before the birth of Jesus on that little A6 card. And you will see the language of the feast there in chapter 25, verse 6. "On this mountain, the Lord of hosts will make for all peoples a feast of rich food, of well-aged wine, rich food full of marrow, aged wine well refined." The host of the heavenly banquet, the kingdom of God, is none other than God himself. As we would expect, God knows how to throw a party. The wine is vintage. There's no student budget, screw top, one glass, serious headache, homebrew. It's the finest vintage from the vineyards of Bordeaux. The food, a combination of Jamie Oliver, Marco Pierre White, Rick Stein. It mentions rich food full of marrow, but you can be sure that if that's your bag, there's a vegetarian option for you. And best of all, or I think probably second best of all, in God's heavenly banquet, you'll see there on that little card, verse 8, "He will swallow up death forever. The Lord God will wipe away tears from all faces." Verse 7, "He will swallow up on this mountain the covering that is cast over all people." God is there in his heavenly kingdom. And in God's heavenly kingdom, there is no death, no suffering, no pain, no mourning. Notice, it's not a disembodied experience of spirits sitting on a cloud strumming harps. It's remarkably earthy. It's not a picture of drunken excess or gluttonous greed. There's none of the kind of obscene and grotesquely ungodly 72 virgins. There's no waking up to a Basra or an Aldgate or a Darfur or a tsunami. And in order to show us that this, we are right to long for this heavenly kingdom, and that it's not just pie in the sky when you die pipe dream, Jesus breaks into history in the first century, and he shows himself, if you like, ahead of time to be the Lord and King of God's heavenly kingdom. Now, in the section there in the Gospel, we've had Matthew's account of the meaning of the life of Jesus. There are a whole series of different incidents demonstrating Jesus to be the King of God's heavenly kingdom. And he does all sorts of things that you would expect God's heavenly King to do. In fact, I would suggest you would be the first to complain to me. If I was to stand up here and say Jesus is King of God's heavenly kingdom, and there were no unusual things that Jesus had done. So just scan through the pages. You'll see page 19, he cleanses a leper. Page 20, he calms a storm, he heals many. He deals with evil. Page 21, he heals a paralyzed man, and he raises a dead girl, a 12-year-old, to new life. As I say, that's the kind of behavior you would expect of God's heavenly King. I would suggest, though, that just the incident of the centurion servant that we had read to us just now is sufficient to demonstrate to us that Jesus is who he says he is. I mean, imagine if you were a medic, and imagine if someone were to come to you with the request of that verse 6, chapter 8, verse 6 on page 19. Lord, my servant is lying paralyzed at home, suffering terribly. What would you be doing? Well, you would be organizing the ambulance. The physios would be put on standby in the hospital. You would be booking a bed if there was one available. You'd be needing weeks to help this guy. His muscles are withered, his limbs are contracted. You know, I once asked a medical friend of mine, you know, what does it take to cure a paralytic? What's gone on with that person? And he said, have you ever had a limb in plaster? Yes, 12 weeks, a leg. What was it like when it came out? Well, the muscles were withered. It took a full year of physio, weights and training to reach the peak of physical fitness that you see standing in front of you this afternoon. And yet Jesus, with just a word, at a distance, speaks, and at once this servant is cured. Verse 13, to the centurion Jesus said, go, let it be done for you as you've believed, and the servant was healed at that very moment. Here then is the point of these two chapters. It's to give us clear, historical, eyewitness evidence that Jesus is the King of God's heavenly kingdom. That Jesus is the one who will roll back the shroud of death that covers us all. That Jesus will preside at God's heavenly banquet. And that Jesus has come early, breaking into history, to demonstrate to us that he is God's eternal King and to invite us to make the investment decision of a lifetime. So I am wanting us to consider that decision this afternoon, a decision not just for 10, 20, 30, 40 years' time, but a decision for us personally for 120, 240, 480 years' time. I wonder where you think you and your friends and your family will be then. It's unlikely that any relative will ever even mention your name. Do you know the first names of your great-great-grandparents? I doubt it. There was somebody earlier last week who I think every first male child in their family had been called Arbuthnot or something for the last 8 generations, and so it wasn't a difficult call. Our wealth and our qualifications, our careers, our mortgages, our children's education, our possessions, our health plans, all those things will be utterly irrelevant. Only one thing will matter. 8 days after Christmas, I stood in the rain outside Bodmin Crematorium. We were saying goodbye to Roger, and Roger was almost like a member of our family in some ways. We kind of grew up together, Roger and I. I'd known him since he was 12 and I was 14. He came to work with us on our family farm as soon as his feet reached the pedals on the tractor. And as the curtain closed around his coffin, and as the coffin was lowered, and as we filed out and shook hands with his wife Shirley and Alan and Philip and Dawn, his brothers and sisters and his kids, there was only one thing that really matters. Only one question. Where is Roger? Of course, it leaves us asking the question, doesn't it? How does one get included into the heavenly kingdom? How does one come to be part of this glorious future that God has planned for his people? Which brings us to the second area that I want us to explore. If first, Jesus is the king of God's heavenly kingdom, secondly, it seems, faith in Jesus brings inclusion in God's heavenly kingdom. And I think the point is made quite brilliantly by our friend the centurion, who we're going to get to know a little bit over the next few minutes. As we look at this Roman officer, there can be no doubt that Jesus includes him. So if you just look over the page there, you can see, "Truly, I tell you, with no one in Israel have I found such faith. I tell you, many will come," and the implication is like this guy, "from east and west and recline at the table with Abraham, Isaac and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven. While the sons of the kingdom will be thrown into outer darkness. In that place there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth." So there's no doubt, is there, that the centurion is included, and that's the sons of the kingdom, that is the religious elite of the day, who thought that they would get in on their own qualifications without Jesus, are excluded. And what is striking, that there seem to be just two qualifications for this guy, and that they seem to have nothing to do with his religious pedigree or his racial background or his track record morally. Rather, the centurion is welcomed simply because of his view of himself and his trust of Jesus. Just turn back a page and have a look at what the centurion says in verse 7 there. "Jesus said to the centurion, 'I'll come and heal your servant.' But the centurion replied, 'Lord, I'm not worthy to have you come under my roof. Only say the word, and my servant will be healed.'" Now, I've got no idea what has gone on in this guy's home, or in his bedroom, or around his kitchen table. We're not told his viewing habits or his drinking habits. We know nothing of what he dreamed about, or how he treated his wife or his past girlfriends. We only know that as he considers his own life, and as he thinks about the majesty and the glory and the purity and the perfection of Jesus Christ, this guy says, "Actually, Jesus, I recognize that I've lived my life with no reference to God. Please, I'm just not worthy to have you come under my roof." And I think the point is made all the more strongly when we consider who the centurion is. He is the local ruling governor. So he's the equivalent of the commanding officer of the 1st Battalion, the Royal Green Jackets, in that particular part of town, out in the equivalent of, you know, the commanding officer of a battalion in Basra or something like that. What he says goes, and Jesus is just the carpenter's boy. He'd obviously heard the teaching of Jesus and his gentle humility. Maybe he'd seen the living of Jesus, his moral purity. Perhaps he'd watched the miracles of Jesus, his majesty. Maybe he'd seen the power of Jesus, his just sheer divinity. And as now he thinks of Jesus and of himself, he says, "Look, I'm just not worthy." Seems to me this is the first mark of the man who will be welcomed in God's heavenly kingdom. You say, I know nothing about your own home, it's none of my business, and the majority of you know very little about my home, and I consider it to be none of your business. There is going to be no grand revelation this afternoon. But I've been alive now for 44 years, and there are many, many things in my life that speak of an underlying attitude of rejection of God, pushing him off to the sideline of my life and living in God's world, though sustained by him, under the banner, I'll do it my way, as a rebel, if you like. And I have to say that my life is pockmarked with incidents, which I'm not going to tell you about, of which I am rightly, deeply ashamed, and which speak of an inner attitude in God's world of, thank you very much, I'll run this show myself. You'll be the same. And the first step to inclusion seems to be to come clean, to say to Jesus Christ, yes, I recognize I have lived like this. I recognize your awesome majesty, and I see that I'm just not worthy. The wonderful thing about this incident, it seems, that if only we will come clean with God and turn to Jesus Christ, away from that life, there appears to be inclusion. Do you know the bad news about this passage? I think the bad news about this passage is that if we are so smugly self-righteous that we think we can kind of waltz into God's perfect heavenly kingdom on our own merits, then we're like the sons of the kingdom. And Jesus says they will be cast right outside. So that's, I think, the first qualification. The second mark of inclusion is there in verse 9. I'm going to read it from the second half of verse 8. Only say the word and my servant will be healed, for I too am a man under authority with soldiers under me. I say to one, go, and he goes. To another, come, and he comes. To my servant, do this, and he does it. When Jesus heard this, he marveled and said to those who followed him, truly, with no one in Israel have I found such faith. Do you notice that the faith of the centurion isn't a superstitious thing? It's not a kind of blind or a mindless or an irrational thing. He doesn't take a blind leap in the dark or suspend all his faculties of reason. It is a rational, intelligent, careful, calculated, logical conclusion that he comes to. And the logic is spelled out for us there in verse 9. In the Roman system, all authority belonged to the emperor. Maybe it's like that in your office. And what the emperor said went, but the emperor delegated authority to his military leaders, and as a military leader spoke, it was as if the emperor himself was speaking. And our centurion looks at Jesus and says, I can see that you speak with all the authority of God. It is a clear recognition that Jesus Christ is king over God's heavenly kingdom. And that, I think, is the qualification. To turn from the life that says, I will run my life my own way, to turn to Jesus Christ, to recognize who he is, demonstrated for us in history. Back in the autumn, my wife and I went to a wedding of a friend who I'd known for over 30 years. I used to live with John and his family for a while, and I was great friends with John and his sister Camilla. I hadn't seen Camilla for about 20 years. It was quite a depressing event, actually, in one sense, because I met Camilla for the first time in the queue on the way into the reception, and she looked at me, and there was a sort of faint recognition, and turned away, and then dawned. She looked back and exclaimed, oh my gosh, as if rarely in the history of humanity has time wrought such havoc on any individual person. But you know, at that wedding, the invitation list, if you like, the people at the party, well, it was totally predictable, absolutely obvious. I mean, everybody who you would expect to be there was there. But the guest list in Jesus' kingdom is going to be quite a surprise, I think. For in Jesus' kingdom, well, the guest list is going to be made up of people who have recognized the glory and majesty of Jesus, who have turned from that life, living with Jesus, just shoved off onto the sidelines as an also-ran, who'd seen his authority and looked to him for help. To the person who says, I'm not worthy, and to the person who turns to trust Jesus, it appears Jesus says, join the party. Not just join the party. Here's the top table. Come in. Take your place. Have you met Abraham? Isaac? That does, of course, leave the question, how on earth can this be? How can this be? And I think the answer comes in the third point, which I'm just going to allude to very briefly. It's down at the bottom of the next paragraph on page 20, where Matthew tells us this was to fulfill what was spoken by the prophet Isaiah. He took our illnesses and bore our diseases. And the third point is this, the cross, or forgiveness, is the key to God's heavenly kingdom. First, Jesus is the king. Second, faith brings inclusion. Third, the cross is the key. Verse 17 there, you can see Matthew is quoting from Isaiah. It's his own translation of Isaiah chapter 53. Just pick up that A6 card again for a moment and turn it over and you'll see Isaiah 53 written out there for us. And in this prophecy, God promises that God's king will bring about his kingdom through rescuing us from our lives of rejecting God. You can see it from the language. Look at verse 5. He, that is God's suffering king, was wounded for our transgressions. Transgressions means saying, pushing God off to the sideline and saying, I'm going to run this my own way. He was crushed for our iniquities. Iniquity is just a fall short of God's perfect standards. Upon him was the chastisement that brought us peace. With his stripes we are healed. Now, do you see the language of punishment there? That God's suffering king will be crushed, will be chastised, if you like, wounded, for all that we have done wrong as we've pushed God off to the sidelines of our life. That's the cross. What was going on the cross? Well, Jesus Christ, God's King, was carrying in his body, on that tree, the judgment of God at your rebellious life and mine. So that as we say, look, I see who Jesus is, I'm just not worthy, I'm sorry. And as we turn to Jesus for help, we meet the King who has died for us and offers us forgiveness. Well, my time is up. I want us to think about an investment decision that really matters. I mean, you're going to be going back to your desks and there'll be plenty of trivial investment decisions for a few million, perhaps. This is an investment decision that really matters. Where do you think you will be in 120 years' time? 240? 480? Of what significance will be the things with which we fill our lives at the moment, if we are not in Jesus' heavenly kingdom? Ultimately, it is the single most important investment decision we will ever face. Many of us will need to do more research. I mean, I guess many of us will say, well, look, you know, I can't make a decision like that just like that. In which case, I would strongly encourage you to fill in that response form and to spend a few lunchtimes, just a few lunchtimes, investigating the claims of Jesus Christ. Yeah, there may be somebody here today who says, well, it's time for me actually to make that decision and sign on the line today. In which case, why don't you ask a question about how to do it? Because my time is up and it'll have to come in the question and answer session. Right, we're going to take, I think, 5 minutes. So you can just discuss things around your table and fill out a question if you'd like to put one in. Maybe you'd fill in a question from each table, or perhaps you've got your own question you want to fill in. And then in 5 minutes' time, we'll spend 10 minutes just looking at some of the answers. Well, I think if I may break in. Sorry to butt into conversations. I guess there's a lot of questions and discussion going on around tables, but it's worth picking up these three really excellent questions that we've been given. First, if those who follow in Jesus' ways are included in the kingdom of heaven, then what of those who do not or do not believe? As a Christian, is it right to believe that there will be an exclusion for non-believers? I can't say I think there will be exclusion. For example, everyone in this hall has insight into Jesus' life, teachings, and ways. What of those who have never been shown or been exposed to the teaching of Jesus? Well, this is, I think it is a very important question to try and tackle. It's an extremely hard one to answer because I don't think the Bible, because of what the Bible is, assumes that once you've got the account of Jesus' life in your hands, you have heard. So there's not a kind of absolute direct, here is the question, here is the answer. Because it's not a question for us. Once we've got the Bible in our hands, we're not included in that group. But it is the kind of question that I think anybody with an eye and concern for somebody else will be interested in hearing an answer to. I want us just to turn forward, if you would, please, to page 41. And chapter 15 of Matthew, there's a dispute going on about what makes a person right with God. And Jesus summarizes his teaching in verse 19. Out of the heart come evil thoughts, murder, adultery, sexual immorality, theft, false witness, slander. These are what defile a person. In other words, his assumption is, at every point, that it's out of our human heart, the center of our being, that evil comes. In fact, in a previous discussion, he says to the religious leaders of the day, you, though you are evil. Straight assumption. Just turn over the page again to page 58, if you would. 59, in fact. The greatest commandment. And a lawyer, or a teacher anyway, at the top of page 59. Teacher, verse 36 there. Teacher, which is the great commandment in the law? And Jesus said to this lawyer, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, and all your mind. This is the first and greatest commandment. Now, I think because we so often leave God out of the picture, we tend to make our kind of moral evaluation of people on a horizontal level. Because God made us and is rightfully in authority over us, whether we acknowledge or not, the Ten Commandments begin with the vertical. And Jesus summarizes the first four of the Ten Commandments. Actually, the Old Testament summarizes it like this. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength. Now, that's got to be right. If God is God, then it's only right that he deserves all of my energy and so on. Which of us has done that? Who in the whole world has done that? Interestingly, even the reader of, I've written down here, even the reader of the Daily Mirror knows that he's done wrong. What I mean by that is, even if you have no conception of God at all, as you look at, you know the difference between right and wrong. All of us know that there are some things that are right and some things that are wrong. So even the reader of the Daily Mirror, and if you are a reader of the Daily Mirror, please, you know, don't, I'm using this just as a kind of allegory. But even the person who might not acknowledge God at all still knows what is right and what is wrong. And even that person, on occasion, says to themselves, I've done something that is wrong. So I want to suggest that everybody in the whole world actually stands on the wrong side of God, conscious or unconscious? This question, and as we answer this question, makes the assumption that actually, well, we're all basically pretty decent and God ought to usher us into his kingdom. When Jesus, in all his perfection, walks onto the earth, he reorganizes our moral decisions and says the first moral issue is, do you recognize God as your Lord? If you don't, which we don't, then that is the greatest sin, to reject God. Second, what about your neighbor? And as we look at our neighbor, we realize all of us have actually blown it there too. And therefore, the issue is one, not of how am I doing according to the benchmark, because all of us have fluffed it. The issue is, will I recognize that I've fluffed it? And will I come for forgiveness? And Jesus teaches that he is the only one who can give us that forgiveness, which is why Matthew's gospel finishes with the command to the Christian to go and tell everybody. So I hope I've given just a framework. I say it's not kind of directly addressed in the way of this question in the Bible. I hope I've just given us a framework for an exploration. The issue is not where is the person who's good enough, or surely that person is good enough. No, none of us is good enough. Let's be straight about that. If you think you're good enough, then you are the smugly self-righteous, and you'll never get in, ever. Here's a question on hell. What is the outer darkness in verse 12? Is it hell? If so, how can the sons of the kingdom end up there? How can one make sure that they don't end up there? The sons of the kingdom refer to the Jewish elite of the day who were saying, well, you know, look at my racial pedigree. I'll be all right then. And who didn't look at the perfection of God's 100% just demand and say, I've blown it. And to the smugly self-righteous, what Jesus elsewhere calls those who think they are so well they don't need a doctor, Jesus says, well, if you won't come to me for forgiveness, there is no hope. You know, if you're walking around with cancer saying, I'm absolutely fine, you know, I've felt better in my life, and you refuse to go to the surgeon, the one who can cure, there's no hope. And I think it's very helpful for us, particularly in our sort of recently vaguely Christian culture, that actually it's addressed to the sort of self-righteous. Because I think in a post-Christian culture, a lot of us think, oh, well, you know, I'll bluff God on the day. I'll be all right. I managed to bluff the client. Should be able to bluff God. And Jesus says, no, that actually God has got to be fair and just and right. The standard has to be 100%. He can't make the standard 44%, you know, for William Taylor and 43% for somebody else. I mean, the 43% or the 42% person will be saying, well, hold on a second. Where's the justice in that? God has got to be 100%. And the smugly self-righteous person who says, well, you know, I'll pull it off, there's no hope for that person. Last question, briefly. Christianity is not a 50-50 option. You can't just take the bits you want, leave out the bits you don't like. Good point. If that's the case, how can we make the first steps in investment if you don't feel 100% Christian yet? Yeah, well, we often don't feel. The feeling isn't actually the issue. The issue is, have I turned to Jesus and asked for forgiveness and committed my life to following him? I think that question suggests that the questioner thinks that maybe if I became 100% Christian, I'd have to be pretty weird. Well, you'd have to be prepared to put up with the snide comments and being the butt end of Channel 4 television programs and that sort of thing, yes. But actually, when you become 100% Christian, God wants you to be 100% Christian wherever you are, whether it's in the city or as a, you know, international tennis player or whatever your particular thing is. The key issue is, am I turning to Jesus to follow him as my Lord and King? The incident immediately after the one we were looking at here has somebody saying to Jesus, oh yeah, I'll follow you in a minute. I've got something else I want to do right now. And Jesus says, leave that alone. Come and follow me. So you're right to say it's 100%, yes. How do you investigate? Well, first step might be to take this Matthew's Gospel and read it. Read a chapter a night or a chapter a morning. I would strongly encourage you to look into the Christianity Explored course that runs here at lunchtime. It is an excellent way to investigate. This next week, we start a new series, What a Body. It did once say, What a Body, William Taylor, but that has been removed from the invitation. It now says, What a Body. We're looking at the resurrection of Jesus Christ. It's nothing to do with anything else. So you might like to come back and begin to investigate with the person who's invited you here and just hear the truth of Jesus. You know, that's the right thing to do. That's what the centurion had obviously done, looked at and investigated and seen. And then he made a right, logical. But if you're somebody who's saying, oh, well, first, you know, I just need to pay off the mortgage first, then you haven't realized yet who Jesus is. Jesus commands you to turn and follow him. It's a moral issue. He is God. And as you turn to follow him away from a life of rebellion, you'll find he's the one who forgives. It's wonderful. And welcomes you in. I think we'll finish there. I'm sorry, we're just slightly over. And I do hope you'll be able to come back next week, or maybe on Tuesday. The people who brought you will be able to tell you all about it. And thank you very much indeed for coming. We'll let you know when something like this is going on again next.